Welcome to Chapter 4 on Mutual Funds, Investments for the Masses. Dear students, as you enter the benevolent machine and trade your life for a paycheck and the paycheck for the rent and the mortgage and the orthodontia and the car payment and the internet service and the cell phones and the cable, etc., 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 chances are you will be offered an employee-sponsored retirement plan. And we'll discuss these in more detail later. I have an example of one that is courtesy of Southwestern Community College. And another one which you're going to research, which is the federal employees version of a 401k plan. And in those plans, the investment of choice is a mutual fund. So you are going to need to educate yourself in how to deal with these things, folks. So for that very reason, whether you finish this class or not, you should really concentrate on this chapter on mutual funds. So let's get started on slide number 2. What is a mutual fund? Well, in chapter 1, when we were doing our overview, we said that a mutual fund is an investment company that invests its shareholders' money in a diversified portfolio of securities. And I like the term investment company. That's the legal term. That's in the law. That's what it's called. But everyone outside the industry and inside the industry also will refer to it as a mutual fund. The only time you're going to hear investment company is if you're in the industry. And, dear students, you get two wonderful, or at least they can be wonderful, advantages. Two wonderful aspects of mutual funds that set them apart from many other investments, in that you get professional money management and instant diversification, both of which are difficult for individuals to get on their own unless they have a lot of money, right? And each fund has a specific objective. And there are over 10,000 funds to how can there be 10,000 funds? That just doesn't make any sense. Are there 10,000 different types of breakfast cereal in the aisles of the grocery? Well, it seems like that. No, they're not. They're not. Are there 10,000 different types of cars? And no. What's going on with these things? Well, we will see, not in the third presentation, we will see how the industry has just exploded with all these different options and choices for mutual funds. Indeed. And of course, because of competition, when one company introduces a new type of mutual funds, dozens of other companies have to follow suit. And as we already mentioned at the bottom of slide number 2, many people choose the mutual funds for their retirement accounts. 401ks, 403bs. What silly names. Well, the names come from the sections of the Internal Revenue Code that allows employers to create these entities for their employees. The traditional IRA, the Roth IRA. We'll spend some time regarding these at the very end of the semester. They are discussed in detail in the financial planning and money management class. So let's take a look at slide number 3. And this graph should look familiar. I'm proud of this graph, folks. I know I didn't get the artistic gene in my family. Here we are, folks. We're the little people. And more of us are women, because women are realizing that they have to take matters into their hands, because often the man of the house isn't necessarily the best money manager, and the young women of today are looking at their grandmothers and their mothers and realizing that the guys, their husbands, really did a horrible job, and the grandmothers and sometimes the mothers were not as aggressively monitoring what the man of the house was doing, and boy did he screw up. And in the case of the grandfather, he died and left the grandmother penniless. Yeah. And what we do is we give our $50 or $100 a month to the people in the top hats. Now, I know that I don't know what they look like, but they're supposed to look like top hats. And these are the professional money managers. And dear students, more and more of them are women, which is cool because it's already been shown statistically that women make better investors. Now, I'll leave it to you to decide why that is true. They're not trying to come up with cause and effect. They're just saying the correlation. If you're a woman in the industry or outside the industry, you are, have a better chance of being a good investor. And there are various reasons for that are posited that are brought forth for this phenomenon, but we will just not discuss those at this time. And what they do, folks, with that money that the millions of people are giving them, they create billions of dollars in these pools of money. And that's why you hear the term mutual fund. But as we said, the legal term is investment company. And what do they do with it? Well, if it's a stock mutual fund, they buy stocks. If it's a bond mutual fund, they buy bond. And if it's a short-term money market mutual fund, usually people just call it money market, they buy the same corporate paper and treasury bills and banker's acceptance notes that we talked about in Chapter 1 in the short-term investments. And they don't buy 5 or 10 stocks or 5 or 10 bonds or treasury bills. They buy hundreds. Hence the instant diversification. So your 50 bucks buys 25 cents of General Electric and 30 cents of AT&T and 5 cents of IBM. Are you with me? Understand that's how it works. And what we see here is just the beginning of the explosion of different types. A balanced mutual fund says, hey, we'll invest both in stocks and bonds. And as I said, we're going to see that there are dozens and dozens of types and hundreds and thousands of funds. So, on slide number 4, we take a look at the growth of the mutual fund industry. It did not start in 1940. The mutual fund industry actually started in the 1920s with a few mutual funds scattered around the country. However, there was no one regulatory entity that looked over the mutual fund industry. And in fact, some states were very wary about these things and did not like them because they were just brand new and the regulatory agencies didn't know what to do with them. Well, in 1940, the Congress, our Congress, folks, you know, Republicrats and demagogues, whichever side you hate the most, they got together and they worked out the Investment Company Act of 1940, which set in the regulatory structure, which created the regulatory structure for mutual funds. At the time, there were already 70 mutual funds. 30 years later, it had grown to 350. And then 10 years after that, 600. And look at what happened between 1980 and 1990, right? Oh, boy. You start to see the explosion. And then in between 1990 and 2000, it goes exponential. We wind up with 9,000 of them at the turn of the century. And since then, we've added another almost 1,905. So we're, as of the end of 2013, 10,905. And where do you get this data? From a trade group, nonprofit trade group, that is sponsored by the mutual funds. It's called the Investment Company Institute. And they come out with, I think it's around every May or so, their huge volume of information, the mutual fund handbook, and it's a lot of fun for people who really like to delve into statistics and And as of December 31st, 2013, 10,905 of these things. Yikes. Slide number 5. In 1980, folks, before we saw the huge growth, 5 million Americans owned mutual funds, holding just 3% of their household financial assets. And then as of December 2013, 96 million, a little over 96 million Americans in 56.7 million households own mutual funds. That's approaching 50%. And why is that? Well, as we said, much of that is because people are being offered these things at work for their retirement. But they're also, they become institutions in and of themselves, and you see advertisements like crazy, and people certainly want to invest, and so it's not just retirement accounts. As of December 2013, there were 17.1 trillion dollars in these things, folks. 22% of household financial assets. Mutual funds are now the nation's largest financial intermediary, which means they hold money for somebody else. The next is commercial banks, and then life insurance companies. Yeah, life insurance companies are often called the invisible bankers. Don't trust a life insurance company with your investments. Oh, we'll get into this later on at the very end. We talk about annuities. Remember, I'm not only a broker, I'm also a life insurance agent, and I can tell you that don't trust a life insurance. I'm going to get in trouble. Oh, well. In the bottom, you might not be able to see this on your little screen if you're looking at this little screen, but at the bottom, in the fine print, and you're never supposed to use fine print in a slide, but I couldn't fit it all in one. I didn't want to create its own slide, but I wanted to just go back a few years. 2013 was a very good year. 17 for the stock market. $17 trillion at the end. Well, at the end of 2012, that was $14.7 trillion. So you see, boof, you know, almost a little over $2 trillion. At the end of 2011, it was $13 trillion. At 2010, it was $13.1 trillion. Bumped down a little bit there. And at the end of 2009, it was 12.1, well, almost 2 trillion. But look at what happened in 2008, 10.35 trillion. And at the end of 2007, it was almost 13 trillion. So you see what happened? As we discussed in Chapter 1, 2008 was a very rough year. Slide number 6. What are the advantages of mutual funds? Well, we've already gone over the two major advantages. Pooled diversification, or just diversification, a process whereby investors buy into a diversified portfolio of securities for the collective benefit of the individual investors, hence the term mutual fund. And this variety provides some safety that is difficult for an individual investor to obtain on their own. Yeah, it's hard for an individual investor to buy 100 stocks. It's almost impossible to keep track of all these stocks unless you pay somebody to do it for you. That's what a mutual fund is. And in general, folks, most individual investors usually hold no more than 10 to 20 stocks because the rule of thumb is it takes about a half an hour per week to keep track of your investments. Well, some people a lot less if they're the kind of person who just buys a stock and holds on to it forever. But still, it's just very, very difficult, as we'll see later on when we start doing research on stocks. There's a lot of work to be done. The second major advantage is professional money management. The mutual fund managers are supposed to know what they are doing. They're certainly getting paid well enough. And some of them do a very, very good job, folks. And some of them don't do a very, very good job. Some of them do a pretty bad job. But isn't that true of virtually anything? You go to a baker, and sometimes the cake is delicious, and some bakers, oh, what's going on here? Or restaurants, or whatever. You know, there's a spectrum And what we want to do is find the best money managers, in my humble opinion. Two items that we don't often talk about when we discuss mutual funds are the low initial outlay of capital. Most all mutual funds will let you start with $25 or $50 per month. I mean, what could be easier? People think they need $5,000 to invest. No, $50 a month. Some people will say, well, I don't have enough money. I say, can you afford $50 a month? And they go, no. Well, what's your cell phone payment? Oh, it's $100 a month, but it's supposed to be only $50, but I download a lot of ringtones. And the second item that we don't discuss is the PETA factor. Now, I wish I had come up with this. I cannot claim responsibility. This is from The Wealthy Barber, which is a wonderful book. It's a little outdated. The numbers are all wrong, but the concepts are spot on. And he describes the PETA factor as the pain in the... It's true. Once you've decided upon your mutual fund, it's easy. Now, as we'll say at the very end, judiciously keep track of these things. You know, don't buy and sell these willy-nilly, although some people do. You're investing for the long term, right? They're mutual funds, right? They're for the long term. So once you've chosen your mutual fund, then there's not much for you to do. It's their job to pick the right investments for you. Now, slide number 7. What are the disadvantages? What are the drawbacks? Well, nothing's perfect. And mutual funds have transaction costs. Some mutual funds charge sales fees, called a load, sales charge, sales commission. There are front-end loads. There are back-end loads. There are sneaky in-between loads that we're going to discuss in detail in the next presentation. And many other funds have no loads. They have no commission, no sales charge. And you say, well, wouldn't I want one of those? Well, you got to be careful. Some no-load funds can wind up costing you more than load funds over time. Why? Because of the next item, the annual operating expenses. The mutual funds are not doing this for their health, folks. They're businesses. They're in it to make a profit. And so every mutual fund is going to charge you annual operating expenses, whether or not they have the sales charge. And so if you get a mutual fund that has a high annual operating expense, it can wind up costing you more than the one that has the transaction cost and a low annual operating expense. And as I said, we're going to deal with this in detail in the second presentation, where we discuss fees. Many mutual funds don't match the market's performance. What? Aren't the mutual fund managers supposed to know what they are doing? Well, it sounds like something fairly innocuous, being able to match the market's performance. But in reality, it ain't that easy, folks. In fact, it's downright hard. Why is that? Because of the fees, right? You've got one hand tied behind your back already. You've got to beat the market by the annual operating expenses just to stay up with it, because the market itself doesn't have annual operating expenses. And we'll discuss this in more detail in our next presentation. Psst, some mutual funds do very well and beat the market's performance over decades. Slide number 8. We are going to spend some time now on the difference between open-end and closed-end funds. Most people don't even know that there is a difference. There are very few people who actually invest in closed-end funds. They are a shrinking part of the business. But you, dear students, are introduction to investment students, and you need to know this. All right? Okay, good. Open-end versus closed-end. Virtually all mutual funds are open-end, greater than 80% of them. An open-end mutual fund is a type of investment company in which investors buy shares from and sell them back to the mutual fund itself. There is no limit on the number of shares that the fund can issue. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of investors. So you as an investor or any investor can buy shares from, it's called purchasing shares, and sell shares back to, it's called redeeming, the shares back to the investment company anytime. And when people refer to a mutual fund, unless they say, you know, closed-end mutual fund, they are almost always exclusively referring to open-end mutual funds. And as of December 2013, according to the Investment Company Institute, there were almost 9,000 open-ended funds totaling $15 trillion. But at the end of 2012, there was $13 trillion. See, it's for stocks. You know, the bond funds didn't do that great, actually, in 2013, but stock funds did good for their investors. Slide number 9, we see the closed-end mutual funds. Now, closed-end mutual funds operate with a fixed number of shares. What does that mean? Once the mutual fund shares are sold in what is called an initial public offering to the very first investors, and are sold through brokerage firms, then the mutual fund company never redeems or never issues new shares or redeems and destroys old shares. Those 5 million or 10 million or however many shares they had are then bought and sold like stocks on the open market. Do you understand? So you have to buy the shares from another investor. So it might be a little bit confusing to you, and you might say, well, what's the difference? The open-end mutual fund, you buy and sell the shares to the mutual fund company. And they create new shares when you buy, and they destroy, it's called redeeming, they destroy, essentially, the shares when you sell. Whereas the closed-end fund, no. We start with a certain number of shares, maybe 10 million or whatever. I'm just pulling a number out of my hat here. And then once those shares are all sold to initial investors, if you want to buy those shares, you have to go to your broker and say, okay, who wants this? You know, I want to buy 100 shares. And then they buy them from somebody else, and they buy them from another investor. That's the way stocks work, as we'll see when we get to Chapter 5. They are not as popular with individual investors as open-end investment companies. In fact, this part of the world is actually shrinking. The closed-end mutual funds are shrinking. At the end of 2013, there were only 599 closed-end mutual funds holding only $279 billion. So you see, you know, trillions versus billions. And closed-end is very small, and it's getting smaller, because notice that at the end of 2012, there were 602 funds. So it's actually, the number is going down, and they were holding a little bit less, $265 billion, but that's because the market went up pretty high. So it wasn't as great a jump. So the closed-end mutual fund industry is getting smaller. And we're going to see why in a few slides. We're going to see what's replacing it and what's the fastest-growing part of the industry. Slide number 10, the net asset value. Now, I'm not going to ask you to do any calculations. They're all done for you. They're done at the end of the day in every mutual fund company around the country, around the world. That's their job. The book is going to ask you to do a couple of calculations, but I don't care. The net asset value, NAV, you'll sometimes hear people say, is the underlying value of one share in a particular mutual fund. You add up the value of the securities in the mutual fund and subtract any liabilities. Now, normally this is a small number. It's not a very big number because they got to make some payments to some investors or buy some shares of a stock or a bond, and then you divide by the number of shares that are out there. Open-end mutual funds are always sold at net asset value with a sales load added to the load funds, added, you know, with a sales commission. But since closed-end mutual funds are bought and sold on the open market, their price varies. Their price fluctuates. So their price usually either reflects a premium, meaning above, or a discount below the net asset value, and it's usually a discount. They are very rarely priced at their net asset value because there's supply and demand going on. So you think, cool, I could buy something that's worth, you know, $20.50 for $20.25. I get a 25-cent discount. Well, sure, but when you go to sell it, unless this particular closed-end fund gets popular, you're probably going to, again, sell whatever it's worth. Say it's 2 years later, it's worth $27. You're probably going to have to sell it for $26.80 or whatever. There's going to be a discount. Now, some are very popular, so it might sell for a little bit more than that if it gets popular, because there's supply and demand at work. But still, it's going to be close to the net asset value. Make sense? I hope so. And don't worry. If you don't understand it, don't worry. Go back and listen to it again. But you'll understand more about supply and demand and market fluctuations and market how markets work when we get into Chapter 5. So slide number 11 gives us the formula in math notation, arithmetic notation. So we have the value of the funds portfolio. So at the end of every business day, every day that the market is open in New York, the mutual fund company has to scrape together all the different prices of their securities that they hold, whether they're bonds, stocks, or short-term investments. But most short-term investments fluctuate very rarely. And then they subtract out any liabilities. But as we said, the liabilities should be a small amount. This is something, oh, yeah, we owe this company some money, or we owe these investors some money. And then you divide by the number of shares outstanding, how many shares are out there. So let's take a look at this example here. If at the end of the day, the value of the securities were $10,050,000, and they had $50,000 in liabilities, so that's $10 million. I made the nice round numbers. You divide that by the 1 million shares that are outstanding, and you get a $10 NAV, $10 net asset value. So if there's a sales commission, for example, this might have 5% sales charge, that would be 50 cents. So you'll see the offering price is equal to the net asset value plus the sales commission. So not very hard to do. Plus, I ain't going to ask you to do it. It's, you don't have to do these calculations. They're all done for you by the mutual fund industry. Well regulated, by the way. Slide number 12. Now, let's take a look at the advantages, disadvantages of both. Open-end investment companies have no market forces, so you're always able to buy, you're always able to sell. There's a very popular wide range of choices, too wide in my humble opinion. But think about it from the mutual fund's perspective, not from the investor's perspective. Think about it. If you're a mutual fund company, if you have large purchases or large redemptions, it can make your life more difficult. It can make managing the fund more difficult. Why? If your fund does really, really well, all of a sudden you get talked about on some show or something like that, and then you see huge influxes of money. Or you have a bad year, and all of a sudden investors start running for the exits. You are going to have a hard time managing that fund. There are some companies that handle it certain ways. Mostly what's popular is that if a fund becomes very, very popular, the mutual fund company will close the fund to new investors. So nobody knew. We have all the money we want. Thank you very much. So we're going to close the fund. Other companies handle it. Handle it a little differently. Pardon me. But still, it's not something you as an investor have to worry about, unless your fund is hit by it and you don't know what to do. It's something the mutual fund company has to handle. The closed-end mutual fund has some problems. Not that big a deal, but you have to pay the broker's commission, like a stock. You have to pay your broker a commission. And you have to buy and sell them via the marketplace, so there's supply and demand issues. It could be sold at a premium or sold at a discount. But from the, again, let's think about it from the investment company, from the mutual fund's point of view. If you know how many shares there always are going to be, you're going to get a set amount of money when you sell all those shares. You don't have to worry about large purchases. You don't have to worry about large redemptions. You can handle the money as you see fit, and not have to worry whether or not you're going to get a boatload of money coming in or a boatload of money sinking you. And so it's actually easier to run a closed-end mutual fund. Yeah. Okay. So I ask in the face-to-face class, I say, which would you prefer? And most everybody looks at me and goes, I don't know. I think most people would choose the open-end mutual funds. It's certainly what I chose. It doesn't mean that's what you have to do. But as we said, it's a shrinking part of the business. So now let's take a look at slide 13. Because about 20 years ago, these hybrids, these exchange-traded funds, were introduced, and they have exploded in recent years. There's some very good reasons for that. And exchange-traded funds are open-end mutual funds, folks. So there's no limit on how many shares that can be out there. Shares are created, shares are destroyed when you buy and sell them. But they trade on the stock exchange like a closed-end mutual fund. That's why they're called exchange-traded funds. You understand? They're a hybrid. There's no limit to the number of shares like the open-end mutual fund, but the investor must purchase the fund using a brokerage account like the closed-end mutual fund. And so you incur brokerage transaction fees or commissions or whatever you want to call them. But see, the companies are always fighting for your dollars, and a few companies have gotten very smart. Some mutual fund companies have found a way to eliminate those commissions, those transaction fees. They've have opened their own brokerage firms. For example, Fidelity and Vanguard. They advertise quite a bit, so you can't help but hear about these companies. And if you purchase their exchange-traded funds through their brokerage firm, they will waive the commission. Very smart marketing. Now, there's a caveat here, folks. There's a caveat here. Some people use ETFs as trading vehicles. Did you listen to the discussion, the story of John Merriweather and John Gottfried in Chapter 1? Indeed, there are people who are using these ETFs because they can be bought and sold throughout the day as trading vehicles. And if you do that, I can assure you that Vanguard and Fidelity and anybody else is going to say, no. No, we set these things up so that people can put $50 a $100 a month into an ETF and not have to pay $7 or $12 or whatever the commission is every month. That's what we were after. So probably there's a limit on how many transactions you can do. You cannot use these things as trading vehicles without having to pay brokerage commissions. If you want to use them as trading vehicles, your broker is going to get rich and you're probably going to do poorly, but we'll discuss this in more detail later on. I've already told you that if you do want to be a trader, I can't help you that very much. All I can do is try to convince you not to do it. And a recent entry to the industry, 20 years, the ETFs are becoming very popular, and we'll discuss some of the reasons, more of the reasons later on. Look at the growth of the ETF industry. Now, I went from the bottom up this time. Maybe I should have done it the way I did the last time. But still, what we see in 2006 is 359. And then, then in 2013, 1,300 of these things. And notice, 423 billion, 608 billion, 531 billion, 992 billion. Whoa, wait, what could happen? Between 2007 and 2008. Yeah, the industry was still growing, the ETF industry, but notice the steep drop. But look at here, $1.7 trillion now. Yeah, so the ETFs are becoming very popular. And there are some people who are predicting the demise of the open-end mutual fund. The closed-end, as we said, are already shrinking. And they're predicting the demise of the open-end mutual fund. I think that's a little premature, but hey, we'll see what happens. Come back in 5-10 years and see what happens. Slide number 15. How are mutual funds regulated? Well, as we said, there was a time when our Congress worked together and played nice in the sandbox. And in 1940, they created the Investment Company Act of 1940. A an excellent piece of legislation which has stood the test of time and is the foundation of the modern mutual fund industry. See, before this, there was a patchwork of regulatory agencies that weren't quite sure exactly what to do with mutual funds. Because whenever you make money, the IRS is going to, rightfully so, say, yeah, you need to pay us taxes. But when the mutual fund made money, they said, no, you don't understand. We're not making money for us. We're making money for the investors. Don't tax us on the money we made for the investors. Tax the investors. Huh? What's going on here? So the Investment Company Act defined what is called a regulated investment company as a pass-through investment vehicle. Ah, that makes perfect sense. They pass through the returns, the dividends, the interest payments, the capital gains to the investor, the shareholder, and the shareholder pays the taxes. Make sense? It sounds, we take it for granted now, but at the time, this was brand new. So to qualify, an investment company must hold almost all of its assets in stocks, bonds, or other traditional securities. In other words, they have very limited ability to use derivatives. All we know about derivatives is that they derive their value from something else, and they're darn dangerous, right? And other risky strategies. So you know, you buy a stock mutual fund, you are buying stocks. You buy a bond mutual fund, you are buying bond. You buy a money market mutual fund, you're buying the short-term treasury bills and corporate paper and the like. And notice this. It's a little tricky here. Watch this. They must use no more than 5% of their assets when acquiring a particular security. Now, what does that mean? That means they have to buy at least 20 different securities. You see? By law, they are enforcing diversification. Now, most mutual funds buy more than just 20. Some are highly concentrated and may have 40 or 50 stocks, but most have at least 100, some 200, and some a whole lot more. So the idea was to create a vehicle for investors whereby they would enforce the diversification. Now, some mutual funds will say, oh, we only carry 20, 25 stocks. And that's great if they do well. And it's not so great if they don't do well. You live by the sword, you die by the sword type of situation. Whereas if you have 200 stocks and one of them disappears, like Kodak, then the rest of the portfolio doesn't suffer much. And then the last item in the 1940 Investment Company Act was the organization with checks and balances. Now, you civics friends, you political science majors will know what that means, right? Exactly. Those are the things that are gone from our government right now. No, they're still in place, but one wonders. Slide number 16. Here, now this is from your book, I would have turned it upside down. I would have put the shareholders at the bottom, but this is the idea. In this case, they have the shareholders at the top and then filtering down. The mutual fund exists for the benefit of the shareholders. And the shareholders have on their side the board of directors, 75% of which must be independent. In other words, they can't work for the mutual fund company. And their job is to oversee the activities of the fund and make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do. Now, there's a bit of controversy over the years about whether or not the boards are actually doing a good job, and I have at least one link on the website about one board that really was just a rubber stamp, and a lot of these boards are that's what they're called. They're just called rubber stamps for the mutual fund company, and they just approve everything. But not all. Many boards of directors take their jobs very seriously. And they oversee the mutual fund, which is actually a corporation. And the mutual fund exists of various parts. The most important part, and the one you're going to hear the most about, is the investment advisor, the management company. These are the people in the top hats that make the decisions about what investments should be bought and what investments should be sold and what investments should be held. But they don't actually do that, right? They don't actually hold on to the shares. Who does that? That's the custodian. Makes sense? Right, right. So the investment advisors can't run away with the funds. The custodian is usually a bank or a trust company whose job is to watch over other people's funds and assets. So, cool, the custodian hangs on to the shares. What does the distributor do? Their job is to sell the shares, either directly to the public or through brokerage firms or other insurance companies and the like. So these are sometimes called the wholesalers, the distributors. They're the wholesalers, whereas a broker or a life insurance agent or the like would be the retail broker. And then the transfer agent is the entity that actually processes the order, redeems, buys, purchases the shares. So they're the ones who actually take care of all the transactions for the shareholders. And then the independent public accountant is one of the big accounting firms that oversees the operations of the transactions. They do an audit every year, and they certify the fund's financial reports. So they say, okay, oh, you say you have 1,000 shares of Apple. All right, where are they? And they go to the custodian, here they are. They're in this account right here. You understand? Why? Why do they have this big separation duties? Well, obviously, right? They're trying to protect the public. Now, these next two slides are simply a rehashing of what I just described to you in the previous slide. The mutual fund is a corporation run by the board of directors on behalf of the shareholders who actually vote in the board of directors, and usually everybody gets voted in. The investment advisor, the management company, the portfolio managers, the research analysts, these are the people in the top hats who do the jobs. You'll hear them sometimes called portfolio counselors. Sometimes you hear the term star manager, money manager. They go by various names. Sometimes it's a team or sometimes it's a committee. But usually in the industry it's one person. More and more they're realizing they need a team or a committee to do the job. I prefer a team personally. Research analysts are the people who are given the job of going out and knocking on the doors. Sometimes the portfolio managers do it too. But the research analysts focus on a specific industry, or maybe a couple. The distributors, as we said, distribute the shares to the public or to dealers. And when we get to Chapter 5, we'll discuss a little bit the process of an initial public offering. The book goes into very much detail, and as I'll speak to this, we'll speak to this in Chapter 5, if you take the Series 7, you have to learn this process upside down, left side, right. But for most retail investors, we just aren't interested in that world, folks. Yeah. And the same thing is true here. You're not going to deal with the distributor. The wholesaler, as they're called, is going to deal with the people that you deal with. They're going to deal with the brokers and the life insurance agents and the 403B and 401K administrators, unless this entity goes directly to the public, and then you're dealing with the distributor. The custodian holds on to the securities, as we said. The transfer action agent keeps track of the purchases and redemption requests. The independent public accounting firm certifies the fund's financial reports and makes sure there's no hanky-panky. Why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Well, mutual funds are highly regulated in order to protect shareholders' investments from fraud and collapse. How often have you heard of a scandal at a mutual fund company? Really? Have you heard? Until 2003, never. Wait a minute, Brian. Wait, did you just say mutual fund scandals? You want me to invest in an industry that is plagued with scandal? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. Look, folks, it wasn't that big a deal. I mean, it wasn't good. It wasn't good. Since 1940, the mutual fund industry has been regulated and escaped any hint of impropriety. I like that word, impropriety. It means hanky-panky. Yeah. shenanigans, right? Trucos, trampas. But in 2003, some practices that were not quite illegal, folks, they weren't breaking the law, but obviously unethical, were uncovered. Only a handful of funds and a handful of people were affected. And most of these companies, you've heard of Bank of America, but these were Bank of America mutual funds. It wasn't the same as the Bank of America company. But strong funds, Janus, Putnam, poor George Putnam rolling over in his grave, and Alliance. You gotta believe Alliance had a really just a, they just had a bad year. Two people in the entire company, and Alliance is a big mutual fund company, folks. They used to be in the top 10. Two people in the entire company were doing this, and the entire company was tarred with a terrible, bad, you know, what's the word? Bad news, right? The bad news came out. And the worst offender, maybe not the worst offender, but the saddest story was Strong Funds. The guy who started Strong Funds, now is it Richard or John? Richard Funds, Richard Strong. This guy, I mean, built this company from scratch, turned it into a very profitable, very successful mutual fund company, and he was pulling off these shenanigans himself, the CEO. At the time he was doing this, he was worth $600 million. Now, from his shenanigans, he made about $80,000, as I remember. It's either $60,000 or $80,000. I think it's probably $80,000. But $600 million is what his worth was. To you and me, $80,000 is a lot of money. But to somebody who's worth $600 million, and he said it best. He said, what I did was ridiculous. I let down all my friends and family. I have ruined my life for nothing, for basically nothing. And this is the fatal flaw that you hear about in Greek mythology. Here is somebody so powerful and so successful, and yet he does something so stupid because you think you're invincible. You think you're above the rules. Now, what were these people doing? It's a little bit hard to describe. But what they were dealing is they were stealing a penny or two from their fellow mutual fund investors. And you think, well, whoopee. Well, if you got a million in mutual fund investors, you steal a penny, that's $10,000. Bing, right there. You got it? And how are they doing that? Well, it's a little difficult to explain in just a few sentences, but they were using the mutual funds as trading vehicles. They were buying and selling the mutual funds, and they were sometimes doing it after hours when they really shouldn't have been. And they were, for example, if the market fell precipitously in New York, they knew that Japan was probably next because the market opens up in Japan a couple hours after it closes in New York. And so if the market fell precipitously in New York, they would sell their Japanese fund, wait until the next day when the Japanese market probably would fall precipitously, and then buy the Japanese fund back because the prices are all according to the day of in the United States when the market closes. So Japan hasn't opened yet. You understand? See what they're doing? It wasn't illegal, but it certainly was unethical. And Mr. Strong was barred from the industry for life. Don't feel too bad for him because he's got plenty of money. But still, you see how it basically destroyed his life. He now is out of the industry, and whatever he did is just, oh, it's sad. It's sad. I think it's sad. I mean, apart from the money, I'd like to have his problems, right? But still, I wouldn't, your most important thing is your name, right? Yeah, it's right, exactly, your name. In my humble opinion, some people might say it's your health, but yeah, I agree that with that too. So the vast majority of companies never engage in any of these shenanigans, folks. No. And they didn't take a whole lot of money from you. Instead of losing everything, $99,999.99 on a $100,000 account, for those of you old enough to remember Enron or WorldCom or Global Crossing, investors lost a penny on a $100,000 account. Whoopee. It's still theft. It's not right. Yes, indeed. And will this stuff happen again? Not this. There'll be another scandal 40 years from now with something. Who knows? But for the most part, the mutual fund companies have been squeaky clean, folks. Squeaky clean. So, I want you to go back and make sure you understand this, the difference between open-end, closed-end, and then that hybrid, the ETFs, a little bit about how mutual funds are organized. And then when we come back for our second presentation, we will discuss a topic that most mutual fund investors simply don't want to even think about. They know they're being charged. They know that the mutual fund company is not in the business for their health. They know they're being charged. They just don't understand how. You, dear student, will understand how. And you will be the expert. Because when that, I'll discuss it in detail more, but when that three-piece suit walks into the room and tells you how wonderful your 401k is, you'll be able to point out how high the fee is and what it really should be. And if you were a reputable broker and not an unscrupulous broker, you wouldn't be selling us these. I have to keep my blood pressure down. I apologize. So, what do you think, folks? Okay, go back over this. See you in our next presentation when we'll discuss fees.